he's quite right about my approach to training, I'm afraid. This kind of brings me to another thing. I had the very good fortune of commanding that platoon for a full year before we went into battle. So, you know, the men and I had a very good chance to get to know each other. And I'm sure we both stood back and made assessments of each other. One of the assessments was that I was just a kid playing cowboys and Indians. For my assessment of them, I was right most of the time about the private soldiers, but I was wrong about 50% of the time in regard to the NCOs, or maybe I should say 100% of the time, for some were much better than I had predicted to myself, and some had weaknesses I never suspected. By and large, I never got them exactly right as to how a man would, how an NCO would behave in battle. The messing in the battalion during those 10 days was quite unusual in that we didn't have a company kitchen. The battalion prepared one hot meal for the whole force, and we'd come back. It was, you know, the cover was so good, it was relatively easy to make your way in and out of the battalion position once a day for a good hot meal. And it was a help, too, in that you saw the whole battalion together. You felt they were all there with you. Now, I'm coming to a point, a very ticklish point. I think it's got to be mentioned. I'm trusting you to treat it with discretion. If you don't have it, you haven't got the history of the battalion. But our commanding officer, Bradbrook, did not turn out to be a good battle CO. In the 10 days I was in Normandy, I saw him only once. He only visited the company position once. He was loath to leave his slit trench. But the brigadier, Brigadier Hill, who commanded 3 parachute brigade, and again, if you don't get his influence on the battalion and on the brigade, you haven't got our history. He was a tremendous man. Oh, absolutely fantastic. Well, simply the best brigadier that I've ever seen. I haven't had the good fortune to see very many in action. I saw Allard, Jean-Victor Allard in Korea, who was also very good in mind. I'm not trying to decry him, but Brigadier Hill was a truly tremendous man. And so I hope I don't intend to elaborate on that. I hope your other investigation will pick that up. But hey, to the extent that we needed anybody to keep up our morale, we had a great deal of self-containment. I don't remember feeling terribly let down or terribly disappointed in Bradbrook's performance. We had our own convictions, our own integrity, our own standards. So we didn't need model coddling. But still, you know, it's nice to know that your superiors are in there, understand what you're faced with, supporting you all the way, and are themselves brave men. God, you don't want to be led by cowards. So it was Brigadier Hill who visited our company position virtually daily. And not long after this event with the attack on A Company, then my fighting patrol, and he came along and took our company out of its position and led it to reinforce the Black Watch Battalion from the 51st Highland Division. Oh, I got away from the battalion. I think our battalion commander, Bradbrook. I should point out that our battalion was very unfortunate in its COs, or they were unlucky in us, or we were unlucky in them, however you want to put it. The first one, Proctor, was killed before I got there. He was killed in a training accident in Fort Benning. You know, a big publicity event, first Canadian commanding officer to jump out of his plane. Well, some enterprising reporters hired an aircraft to photograph his exit, and the bloody plane wing hit Proctor. So I understand. It should be, again, this is hearsay, you know, lawyers training coming out. You should check that in the newspapers, but it should be possible to do. Colonel Proctor, as I understand it, was hit by a newsreel plane filming his first jump. Then, of course, Bradbrook, who was eventually kicked upstairs. There's an interesting account as to how he was relieved of his command, but I don't intend to tell it to you if you come across it. Otherwise, well, that indicates that you've been lucky and you're on the ball. And then, of course, poor Jeff Nicklin, who was killed in the Rhine crossing. Fraser Eadie was our last commanding officer, but I was then with the training company, so I can't say how what kind of a battalion commander Fraser Eadie turned out to be. Certainly the battalion performed very well under him, so I think he must have been a very good one. But again, I don't know. Okay. I'm almost at the end of this tape. I'm going to have to turn over to the other side. But willy-nilly, you're going to have to do with these two tapes. I've talked twice as long as I expected to. So wherever I happen to be, if I don't get to the end of my notes, I'm afraid that's going to have to be it, Mr. Kane. Well, there's the side four of this fairly lengthy amble. Somewhere along about D plus 7, D plus 8, the Brigadier Hill came along and collected our company and took it in to reinforce the Black Watch Battalion in the 51st Highland Division, who had come in by sea and to take up position and presumably to relieve us of our task so we could get back to England, as it was then intended, for another airborne operation. I understand the battalion, the Black Watch Battalion, had been brought up to strength after its return from North Africa with young, undisciplined, ill-trained slum kids from Glasgow and similar impoverished areas in Scotland. I don't know whether it's true or not, but certainly other accounts have established that the battalion did very badly, and most of the men retreated. When we got there, there were only officers and NCOs holding out. No men at all, or very few. And when I saw what was a Scottish sergeant major departing under dubious circumstances, I wondered what the hell we were getting into. I visited the battalion headquarters of the Black Watch in this lovely French manor house and saw other platoons in my company, C Company, taking up positions to defend this Scottish battalion, or the remnants of it. I myself had been allotted the position in depth, and I went forward on a recce just to see what was on the other side of the wood. We were on sort of the friendly side of a forest is probably the wrong term to use, a grove, a copse, a large copse, but something you know, clearly more orderly than anybody from BC would consider a forest. It was not a forest. There wasn't great undergrowth. There were lots of tall trees, but there was very little undergrowth there. I guess all cleared away. And I took with me as my runner, Boland, We had platoon officers, both a batman and a runner, who was kind of a bodyguard. Boland was part Indian, and or he might have been wholly Indian for all I know. He's very reliable, but I know virtually nothing of his personality. I can't say I made a great effort to find out. I would now, but you know, I've changed a little and become more widely aware. I just finished, incidentally, a book by somebody called Kinsella, Dance Me Outside, about Indians in Alberta and Saskatchewan. It's tremendous. I find I'm reading more about Canadians and Canadian literature here in New Zealand than I ever read in Canada. But at any rate, Boland was very reliable. He would, was very silent. You would stop somewhere, and he would kind of disappear into the background. And you'd think you were all alone, and then you'd move to go forward, and suddenly he would appear from behind a tree or from some other place where he had been hiding, observing, ready to go forward with you. And we came across some, well, we came to the edge, the forward edge of this copse, and there in the far, you know, in the distance was sort of enemy territory, and we saw a German half-track drive up, and the men quickly debussed and started to set up a mortar, and they somehow must have seen us, but because they immediately started firing in our direction. Now, the distance would have been something like 600 yards, which is a long distance to have a clear field in Normandy, that part of Normandy. I don't know why the paddock, to use a Kiwi expression, was so big there, although there's a significant horse pasture in the district. But at any rate, I only had my Sten gun with me, which certainly wouldn't fire 300 yards, and Boland had a rifle which would fire 600 yards, but we decided we better get the hell out of there, and the mortar bombs came whistling down, and it was a matter of, they were ranging on us, I think, and it was a matter of waiting for a bomb to explode and then getting up and running a few more yards while they adjusted the range and put down something else, and you had to flop down before the mortar bomb hit. I was a little luckier than Boland in that I judged it a little finer, and he got caught. He only got a small piece of shrapnel in the small of his back, down around where the kidney was, but he didn't seem to be in great pain or agony. Certainly didn't complain. I bandaged him up and he was able to move all right, but he was evacuated immediately. I got back to the platoon position, and I never found out what happened to him, and I'm sorry, you know. So many bloody things you should have done, people you should have been concerned with, but you never thought of life really going on. You never looked to the future, not truly. Just the fact that you yourself remained alive seemed a tremendous event and a major concern, and you thought that everything, I suppose, would straighten itself out finally, eventually, the end of the war. But there are lot of unfinished business, and I don't know what happened to Bullen. I'm sorry I don't. He's a good man, a good soldier. But I got back to the platoon with Bullen. I patched him up as best I could, and he was evacuated, and I joined Sergeant Davies, who'd been, of course, commanding the platoon in my absence, and Gummy had installed himself in what I presumed to be a mortar pit dug for the Black Watch. It was about 6 foot by 6 foot, and it was around the edge of it, down under the ground, or below the foot of the ground, were boxes of rations. And we'd been, you know, adequately fed, but to have all these lovely goodies, particularly the chocolate bars, we, dug them out and ate them like in a kid's feast. And then a heavy bombardment came down. Real, really heavy. And shells were crashing all around, and trees were falling. And Gummy was sitting there, dead calm. And I said, you know, Gummy, there were about four or five other chaps in that dugout with us. Not dugout, it wasn't underground. A pit. Why weren't you frightened like the rest of us? And he said, nothing's going to happen to me. I'm going to come out this war all right. Now, at about that stage, Ball, my batman, jumped into the pit with us and said he had a good slit trench for us, meaning he and I, with overhead cover. So I dashed across back with him, and his overhead cover turned out to be a 3-ton lorry abandoned by the Black Watch. We sat out the bombardment there, after it was all over, I looked into the back of the truck, and it was filled with 3-inch mortar bombs. Jesus, what an overhead cover. And then I ran back over to the pit to see how that lot had fared. And Gummy Davis had taken some shrapnel in his head. He was unconscious. I bandaged him up, and we got him back to the CCS, but he died a few hours later there. I don't know that he appreciated serving under me. I was very young and very green. But, you know, being young and being green, he was the ideal kind of an NCO to have. He was sort of this kid in diaper officer is in the best pretty British tradition, with a very young or very old solid. Now, old Gummy wasn't old. He was 27, I think. The oldest man in my platoon wouldn't have been more than 32, 33. Gummy, by God. In my platoon, Gummy was the oldest man at 27. So we would arrange an age from 17, Archibald, to 27. Pop Hogarth, I think, was the oldest man in the company. I don't know how old he was. He's dead now. But you might find some reference to that somewhere. He was a good soldier. He had a fine sense of proportion. He was unflappable, is the cliche used then. The modern jargon would be he kept his cool always. I think he was a miner somewhere from somewhere in the Maritimes, Nova Scotia, maybe Cape Breton, I'm not sure. He was married. I think he had a child or two, but I'm afraid I didn't write his widow as I should have done. But at the time, you know, it seemed impossible. Then I became wounded and I was incoherent for a while, and I don't know. I never did, and I regret it. It's one of my many regrets. You can't live this long without having many regrets. Shortly after that, our company withdrew from the Black Watch position. I don't know who took over the Black Watch position. I don't even know who took over our position while we're away. I think they installed odds and sods from battalion headquarters, Canadian Para-Battalion headquarters, to take up the C Company position. But at any rate, we went back to our old position. And by this time, we were down to about 50 men. We would have lost at least 10 men while we're in there with the Black Watch. My company, or my platoon, got off quite light. There was Gummy Davis and I think one other. Being in the reserve position, we happened to be lucky. Although, you know, the reserve position would have been back about 50 yards from the front line, if you want to call it that. But we had good trenches, by and large, so we were all right. And the men were getting a little restless at this stage. We had told we would only be in Normandy for about 4 days. Mind you, when you look back on it, they qualified this. You know, lots of caveats and provisos and reservations and the rest of it, but we didn't recognize these for what they were. We just seized on that 4 day. And when we weren't relieved, there's some slight disquiet, but no serious drop in morale that I recollect. Well, about D plus 10, a German recce patrol came in probing our position again. I don't think they really found out where our company were. So John told me to take out a small patrol and fend them off. I did a wide flanking movement. I think I had about three guys with me. And we got to a point where we exchanged fire and they retreated into a farmhouse, one of these walled stone French farmhouses. And I had a strange weapon to take with me, perhaps, but I had a 2-inch mortar with me. God, who was the mortarman? Bruno. Yeah, he was court-martialed later for some bloody thing. And I remember being asked to give a character reference for him, and I did. Bruno was also one of the men that stuck with me in the assault. And I think the character reference did help in his court-martial. I hope it did. But at any rate, Bruno put a few mortar bombs down, HE, in the French farmhouse, but all we saw were chickens run squawking out of the yard. And I made the silly mistake of walking right back into our position, not taking a cover route, a hidden route. I guess we were so elated at surviving this patrol, which was a little risky, and driving them off. Or maybe I was getting tired and careless, I don't know. But at any rate, I think what happened was that the Germans holed up in the French and simply were observing our conduct, saw where I disappeared into, which is the farmhouse at the end of the road, and I was just reporting to John Hansen, my company commander, when a mortar bomb whistled down. We heard it coming, and we both jumped into the same slip trench. Now, I had at this stage discarded my Sten and was using the Schmeisser I'd picked up from the dead German that Gummy Davis had killed during that patrol action I earlier described. Well, the action of jumping in set the Schmeisser off. Luckily, it jammed after the first round, but the first round went, the bomb exploded, then the gun went off and a bullet went through my hand, and I popped up, looked at my hand, spouting blood, and John Hansen, lots of sympathy, said, "You bloody fool, you goddamn near shot me." Well, we bandaged up my hand. It was numb at first. There was no great pain, but it was a wound that had to be looked at. And it was just about dusk at this point, and I went back to the regimental aid post, and to get there, I had to pass through the all the statuary at Le Mesnil. I don't know what the hell he produced there, but the kind of garden ornaments and little gnomes, and when you went through there, it was at night, it was very eerie, but I was quite gay, and I remember singing Take Me Back to Dear Old Blighty. And when I got to the regimental aid post, they sent me to the CCS, Casualty Clearing Station. We didn't have an MO at that stage. Brebner, I presume you've got the account. I understand that Doc Brebner is now the chief medical advisor of the Canadian Pension Commission and is well worth contacting if you're able to do so, and if I still have a correct address. His position, he had broken a bone on landing and was taken prisoner by the German. I think he was taken to Cherbourg. He was replaced eventually by Dr. Begg, who's now president of the University of Saskatchewan. Again, if you can get him to talk, you'll have a good man. I don't know that you'll be successful, but you should sure give it a try. Dr. R.W. Begg, president, University of Saskatchewan, Saskatoon. But we didn't have a doctor at that stage, and they sent me directly to the CCS, which is at brigade headquarters, or near brigade headquarters. And that night, a heavy bombardment came down. And I remember being very upset because they wouldn't give me back my pistol. When you go into a medical facility, you're supposed to surrender your weapon. and being terribly uneasy, because I thought a German assault was going to come in. That's the way the bombardment sounded, and I had nothing to defend myself with. And this desire for a weapon kept up a long time in my life. In the hospital later, when I was evacuated to England, initially, the nurses, to wake me up, would touch me and stand back, because I would kind of thrash around looking for a Sten gun, looking for a pistol to hold, to be safe when I woke up, and it wasn't there. And there's about 30 seconds, 90 seconds of great uncertainty and distress. But and at this stage, I think I was becoming a little, what's the word? Not hallucinating, no, but certainly not in full possession of my faculties, becoming a little, God, I can't think of the term, I suppose, because I'm blocking on the significant, but certainly disjointed in my thought. I don't know whether they'd given me an injection for the pain, or whether the infection was getting to me. At any rate, the hand became infected, seriously infected. I came close to losing it. Luckily, with penicillin, they cured it. But at a later stage, when I was evacuated to the hospital at Watford, north of London, I couldn't even stand the smell of my hand. I'd fling it way out and then turn my nose the other way so I didn't have to smell myself. More just another thing about threshing around looking for a weapon. In December 44, I went to Ireland to stay with some friends. It was Dr. Freeman, who was an Irish medical officer with the field ambulance. Well, he had given me his father's address, who was also a doctor, and I stayed with his father in Ireland. Well, 20 years I went back there, and I hope I didn't do it, but I had myself and Bill Howard stayed in the same place, and we were called back very suddenly because of the Ardennes offensive when von Rundstedt broke through. So we left at Dr. Freeman's house in Dublin, and this is in December, just before Christmas 44, very hurriedly. And when I visited the place 20 years afterwards, they teased me, asking whether I expected to be murdered in my bed. Apparently, I had left, they weren't sure who was sleeping in what bed. Either I or Bill Howard left a commando dagger under the pillow in our haste to get back for duty. But I survived to return to the CCS and the bombardment. I survived that night. As I think everybody in the CCS did, I don't know, don't remember how close the shells landed. And I was evacuated next morning to the beach. And I remember two things about the evacuation, three things. One, I rode in the front of the ambulance driver because I was walking wounded. But the excruciating pain just from this hand already beginning to throb as he hit various potholes. Well, I imagine what the poor guys in the back were suffering, the stretcher cases. The other two things were on the LS landing ship tank, it was, getting white bread and eating it just like cake. We didn't have white bread in England, of course, in 2 years, and we hadn't had any bread at all in Normandy for 10 days. Just eating that white bread like cake, and back to civilization. And what was playing on the tannoy system, or you know, the kind of the PA system in the ship? They had a radio program on, and they were playing Flat Foot Floji with the Floy Floy. You're probably not likely to have heard that song ever, but it isn't a high mark of civilization. And what? Oh, the other item was that I had never had. I know you're supposed to change your socks daily, but I had never had my boots off for 10 days. And finally, I couldn't do it myself because one hand was bandaged. They took off my shoes, and my socks stood up like rubber boots all on their own. They're just encrusted with dirt. But my feet were tremendously clean, you know? And then when I was in hospital, lying in bed, I was there for 8 weeks, which is a long time in wartime. all the skin, all, you know, the laboriously built up protection of skin from miles and miles, hundreds of miles of route marches, just peeled off. And my feet at the end of it were as smooth and as soft as a baby's bum, and I had to start all over again. Well, I think that's about a good point to leave this account. Say, I haven't much more to tell of the active fighting. I was in the Ardennes. I almost drowned crossing the Maas on a patrol. But that's when I went into Holland. But there was nothing, no great fighting for us there. And that about ends my account, Mr. Kane. I don't know what point of view you're taking in this. Maybe you don't know yourself to begin with. And I have no idea how long your thesis is going to be. If it's, say, not much above 100 pages typewritten, which is most what the dissertations are about here, 150 pages, that's an honors dissertation. And assuming that it costs 10 cents a page to photostat, or however you reproduce your duplicate, triplicate copies, if it's of that order, I would be quite happy to pay for a copy of your thesis when it's done. But not to worry, and I wish you the best of luck. I hope that Mark Lockyer will relent, and unfortunately, I don't have the address of the current president of the association, who is Norm Toseland, T-O-S-E-L-A-N-D. But he's reasonably high up in the accounting branch of Shell Oil at their headquarters in Calgary. Now, if you can find his address and send him a photostat of the letter I sent to Mark Lockyer, maybe Norm Toseland will bring a little additional pressure to bear on Mark to facilitate your gathering of material. I think every assistance should be given to you. And best of luck in your studies, and my good regards, of course, to Dr. Roy. All for now and probably forever.